So who is this President Barack Obama? The man who ran on his opposition to the Iraq War, remember that? His interest in restoring America's spirit of cooperation with the rest of the world and his opposition to aggressive unilateral actions by the United States. His opposition to going it alone. Well, after 4 years in the Oval Office, Barack Obama seems to have a real interest in covert operations, unilateral actions, and aggressive, if secret, operations throughout the world. That, in part, is the conclusion from David Sanger's timely new book, Confront and Conceal: Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Sanger is, of course, friend of the program, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, and sitting right across from me in the studios here in New York City. First of all, David Sanger, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here, John, with you, instead of talking to you from my attic,
as we
do so often.
We need more pictures of the attic for the website, I think. Let's talk about, you know, again, you're a great reporter. You don't have a lot of preconceived notions when you go into something like this, but you did use the word surprising in your title. I'm wondering if you would have expected Barack Obama to have taken such an interest in some of the operations you describe in detail, and we'll talk about them in a moment.
You know, John, I went about writing Confront and Conceal precisely to answer the question, what is surprising about this presidency? I mean, here is a law professor who thinks, I think, with great subtlety about the trade-offs involved in everything from prisoners at Guantanamo to unilateral action to building alliances and so forth. And yet, as I report in the opening pages of the book, President Bush took him aside 4 days before he became president and said, there are two programs that you're going to discover you can't live without. One of them is a drone program over Pakistan. One of them is one that you know about now because of the book called Olympic Games, which was the cyber program against Iran. And over time, the president came to the determination that what America needed was a light footprint strategy. That is, we no longer can afford to send 100,000 troops at a cost of $1 trillion to a faraway country for 5 or 6 years where the occupation of that country builds resentments. And so the light footprint is an effort to use American technology to go in from afar and deal with adversaries, whether it's a group of terrorists or some centrifuges in Iran, or you send in special forces as you did in the bin Laden raid. But that means unilateralism, and that's the great paradox.
Let's talk about the Olympic Games program for a moment. The drone program, I think, is equally important, but it sort of speaks to a different part of Barack Obama's brain, it seems to me. The Olympic Games program, it seems to me, was presented to Barack Obama as a third way of dealing with Iran, using cyber technology, not using military action, not using sanctions, and not using the Israelis, who might have had a predilection to overt military action against Iran and its nuclear program. What was the tool that tipped off Barack Obama that there was something that could be enlarged to Olympic Games, as you describe it?
Well, a slight argument with the presence, with the premise of this, because the Israelis were deeply involved in Olympic Games. They worked very closely with the United States, and that was no accident. The U.S. both needed their talent and wanted to wrap them into the program to show that there was an alternative way of slowing the program without bombing. And so you're right, it was a third way, but it was a third way with Israel.
With the Israelis, well, certainly.
That's right.
How much of the technology is cooperative with Israel or shared with Israel as a way of them testing out weapons that maybe we, the United States or Barack Obama, did not want to use unilaterally?
Almost all of it has been done shared with the Israelis, the Israelis writing code, the National Security Agency writing code. And the effort here was to write a piece of computer code that could leap across the air gap, the moat that has been built around the Natanz nuclear enrichment facility, get inside the computer systems, map out what they look like, then attack those computer systems so that they send the centrifuges, which enrich uranium and move at supersonic speeds, completely out of control. And that worked. It destroyed a good number of them, and one of the attacks destroyed nearly 1,000 of them. But they also ran into a hitch because through an error, part of the program became public.
Well, and the becoming public is really sort of the interesting issue here. On page 190 of your book, you describe someone as a participant in the program who says to you, this is how the argument went to the Israelis, if you do it this way, relying on cyber technology, They won't see it, meaning the Iranians, and the longer we can go before you, the Israelis, have to bomb it, it, of course, being the nuclear facility. Now, the key to that sentence is they won't see it. If this program is disclosed, as it has been by your reporting and the mistake that you describe, is its value as a weapon significantly diminished?
Well, the Iranians figured out about 2 years ago that they were being hit by a computer virus. So, you know, I suspect they didn't learn that from Confront and Conceal. They may have learned some details about how that came to be. But what disclosed this program to the Iranians was that one day a version of the virus was overhyped a little bit. They put a little too much juice into it. And an Iranian engineer came into work one day, plugged his laptop into the computer system physically at Natanz. And apparently, unbeknownst to him, the computer worm leapt aboard his laptop, thinking it was part of the network.
Right.
And then he went home, and he plugs into the internet. And while he's doing whatever he's doing, the virus replicated itself across the internet, or the worm, I should say. And it was at that moment that it became clear that someone or somebody was attacking the system. And the more people dissected the program, the more it became clear it was aimed at the Natanz enrichment plant. What I did for this book was pull on that string and try to figure out how that came to be. Because I looked at it and I said, this doesn't look like a single one-off operation. And In fact, it was a 4.5-year, multi-million-dollar international covert program.
Let's talk drones for a moment. You describe in this book at one point the scene of Lyndon Johnson during the Vietnam War picking targets over North Vietnam in the secret war, the secret bombing, and the not-so-secret bombing of North Vietnam. As we know that history today, and we're reading about it in a sense with the new Robert Carroll book,
sure,
about the Johnson presidency, the early days of the Johnson presidency, here was a man who was overmatched. He was not a national security guy, and yet he was in that Situation Room, sort of drawn into the whole conflict that eventually undid him. To compare LBJ picking targets to Barack Obama picking targets of the drones, it seems to me, is potentially to describe Barack Obama as being drawn into a security seductive kind of environment that he may be overmatched in. Why do you think Barack Obama seems to take such an interest in the drone programs?
He takes interest in both drones and cyber for a simple reason. The political moment, the economic moment, does not allow us to be using traditional forces. And frankly, traditional forces may not be very suited to these threats. Even if you could send an army into Pakistan, you probably wouldn't be very successful sending them up through those mountains. The drone program has been much more successful at that. The difficulty, though, and the reason that he's engaged in it, I think less is to pick targets than to take some targets off the list. I think he's quite concerned, from everything I've heard, that the program not go too far, that it not be picking off people who really aren't necessarily a threat to the United States. Because let's face it, this is, as I describe in a drones and cyber chapter of the book, this is pretty close to targeted killing. I mean, They're looking for individuals.
You know, finally, Senator John McCain criticized the New York Times and you and the administration on the floor of the U.S. Senate, saying that leaks have been deliberate to cast the president in a favorable light here in the middle of the campaign. And I guess I'm wondering, and a lot of people are wondering, is this a product of your reporting, this book here, or is this some access you were granted that might be construed as leaks?
This is a product of reporting. This process has been an 18-month long process in which I pulled on that Stuxnet thread and worked myself from the bottom up to try to figure out what was going on. At some point, you have to go, as any reporter does, to the administration and say, look, this is the story I have, and the story was pretty fully formed by that time. And then they have to decide how they're going to respond to it. I certainly had access to a number of administration officials in discussing the other parts of the book, Afghanistan, the Arab Spring, right, how he dealt with Mubarak, the debates inside the administration about when to pull back from Afghanistan, how to deal with Pakistan.
No, and it's all there in David Sanger's new book. He's the chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. And there's some surprises in there. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Great to be here with you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.